Last week, we chanted and then talked about the Buddha's first teaching, setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. And we talked a bit about this initial insight that he had brought to his friends. This is the, you know, the very first thing he said after his enlightenment to his friends, that he would, that would become his first monastics, his first disciples. He said there is this middle way between sensual indulgence and bodily mortification. That middle way is the Eightfold Path. And then he taught the Four Noble Truths. There is dissatisfaction. There's a cause for dissatisfaction, which is craving. There's an end to that dissatisfaction through the ending of craving. And there's a path to cultivate the end of craving. In the context of this first teaching, or while he was giving this first teaching, one of his friends, Anya Kondanya, realized that realized what's called stream entry. His Dharma eye opened, and he exclaimed, "All things that have a beginning have an end," and that's the annunciation of the opening of the Dharma eye. So we looked at what it might have been about this initial expression of the middle way, and really how suffering and craving are interwoven, that would have unfolded as this beautiful insight for Anya Kondanya, that all things that have a beginning have an end. And so the stories tell us that after this first teaching, they then settled down together, these five friends and the Buddha. So This new community, they were living in a park called the Deer Park. So they're living outside, and they would go for alms either all together, or one of them would go into the town of Sawati, collect alms, come back and share it with the others. And the Buddha kept teaching them. One of the things that the story doesn't emphasize that much, but you know, this piece about the them going for alms and sharing food together, how dramatic that might have been, how that must have been for those five ascetics. You know, they had been practicing this strong ascetic practice, strong bodily mortification practice that was really centered in many ways on fasting and denying the body food and nourishment. And it was the Buddha's taking of nourishment, receiving the gift of milk rice from Sujata, that caused them to leave him, and you know, deciding that he had fallen off the path, and they left. And so no more is said of it, but of course he goes and teaches them, and then suddenly they're all eating. And so this is just quietly present in the story, that you know, they would go for alms, so they would walk in the town, they would eat together in silence, as the monastics do. This is the Buddha inventing a monastic community out of whole cloth. There weren't actually that many other examples of it of the time. There are many roving groups of ascetics, and they all lived in different ways, but the Buddha didn't model his community on anything that existed so far. He didn't start with any particular rules or structures. He began, I think, with a very simple life, you know, going for alms, living outside, and then practicing and studying together based on these insights that he had found. So there they are, practicing together, the very beginnings of a community. They're friends. And in that first week, the Buddha gives a couple more teachings. And in this second full teaching, the teaching on the characteristic of not self or anatta, all of them are brought to full awakening. All of them become arahants with this second teaching. So the second discourse then of the Buddha is collected. It's Samyutta Nikaya, or Connected Discourses 22-59. And it is the discourse on the not-self characteristic. Both the first discourse, setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, and the second one, the not-self characteristic, it's called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. They're both contained within a section of the Connected Discourses that deals with the five aggregates. So you might remember that in the first teaching, the definition that the Buddha gives of the Four Noble Truths begins with, you know, there's the noble truth of suffering or dukkha or dissatisfaction. And then there's this definition of suffering that says, you know, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what you want is suffering. Getting something you didn't want is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. And then it concludes with this phrase, in short, and there's different translations for this phrase, the five aggregates affected by clinging, or the five clinging aggregates, this is an awkward little phrase, is suffering. This is what places that first teaching and this second one in the section on the five aggregates. The aggregates are the khanda in Pali, and the translation of them is form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. And so these two texts are linked partly by their use of the aggregates as their central list. So in the setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, in the definition of the First Noble Truth, the truth of dukkha, in brief, the five aggregates, or the five clinging aggregates, the five aspects of our experience, a khanda is technically like a heap of something. And even more specifically, it's like a pile of firewood. So it's something that burns. It's a pile of fuel. These five types of fuel, or collections of fuel in our experience, when clung to, so when lit on fire, are unsatisfying. Form is bodily form, so it's bodies, but it's also forms seen by the eye. So particularly in the context of lust, when you see another beautiful body and you want to make contact with that, that's some burning. But also when you see something else beautiful and you want something from it, right? Clinging arises. I see the beautiful sunset. I feel the warm temperature. I see the beautiful flowers. I see the nice house. I see my, you know, the friends that I want more contact with. I see and hear and smell and taste and touch things in the phenomenal world, and a desire arises for more contact with them. And that desire is natural, but when it turns into the action of craving, really the heart gets twisted into the belief that if I don't have contact with that thing, I won't be okay, I won't be able to be satisfied. Then there's dissatisfaction. Remember, this is about dissatisfaction. It's not about experience itself. So I could see something and delight in it, but not succumb to craving for it and not be dissatisfied. And so it's entirely possible to appreciate the beauties of the world without craving them. And in a certain way, that's part of our task if we want to be liberated from craving. But that model then works for all of the five aggregates. The first is form. The second is feelings, which is Vedana. This is the experience of things being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So I can have a pleasant experience with craving or without. When there's craving, that's painful. I could have an unpleasant experience with craving or without, right? When there's craving in relation to the unpleasant, that's like, I really wish this would go away. I really wish this pain would cease. And again, I can experience the unpleasantness of pain without craving for it to go away. I could even have the wholesome understanding that things would be more pleasurable if this went away, and maybe it would be, you know, a sign that I was healthier if this went away. I could feel all of those things. I might even feel like this pain is not good for me without craving, without that constriction of the heart that says, because this is happening, I'm not okay. My life is not okay. Existence is not okay. So again, when there's craving in relation to feeling, there will be dissatisfaction. Perceptions is the recognition and naming quality of the organism that we are. So when I see something, I know what it is. And there's a kind of narrative connection. I know that's an oak tree. I know that you are the sangha. I know that that's the computer, and that's the cello, and that's the evening sky, and that's the sound of my family, and this is the sensations of my body. And all of those kinds of recognition can come with craving or not. Right? I can be, one way we might think of this is, I could be attached to the names I use for things, or the stories that I tell about things. And that flows into this fourth khanda or aggregate, which is sankhara in Pali. It's awkwardly translated as mental formations or karmic formations or volitional formations. And it has to do with the narratives that we find ourselves living in, that we spin and that we believe other people's spinning of, and the way that those narratives unfold as choices for us. So it's really about how we interact with story, you know, why we do things, and the drama that we identify, the plot, right? Sankhara is like the plot. I'm trying to develop myself, or I'm becoming free, or I'm working on this thing, or I'm in this struggle. All of those can be true. And the heart can crave or not in relation to them, right? The heart can lose its center or not in relation to them. But really these, you know, these sankhara, these volitional formations, these in a certain way are the heart of suffering, because so much of our suffering is rooted in how we relate to the stories that we're telling about the world, right? Things just as they are just things as they are. And if we can learn to step back from fixated stories, we can have both a clearer witness of like, oh, here's how things are. And you know, the possibility of experiencing them with a bit less identification, fixation, clinging, craving. And the last of the khanda or the aggregates is consciousness, vijnana. This is really the, in this structure, in the structure of the aggregates, consciousness is not so much like the deep, you know, center of our being as awareness, but it's really kind of the technical aspect of you can think of it as sense consciousness. Like, it's just what's present when we are awake and the senses are operating. So just the fact that I can see at all means sense consciousness is operating. That I can hear at all means sense consciousness is operating. And so, you know, I could crave sense consciousness, right? Like, you know, the way that infants have to figure out how to not be afraid to go to sleep. Like, you can actually crave being awake or crave not being awake, for instance. You can get fixated about sense consciousness itself. You know, I wish I weren't conscious of that thing. I wish I weren't conscious at all. Yeah. So this basic structure of the aggregates or the aspects, the khanda, shows up as the medium almost on which this painful experience of craving takes root. Right, we crave form, we crave feeling, etc. So that's the basis of the Dhamma. That's the basis of the Four Noble Truths. Kondanya has his awakening experience. Oh, everything that arises passes. Everything that has a beginning has an end. And then in this second teaching, the characteristic of not self, the Buddha seems to, you know, pick up right from that point and then go forward. And so the text opens like this. The Buddha says to his friends, mendicants, form is not self. For if form were self, it wouldn't lead to affliction. And you couldn't compel form. May my form be like this. May it not be like that. So that's the basic statement. Form is not self. The word is anatta, not self, or not having an intrinsic substance, a separate substance. If form were self, it wouldn't lead to affliction. And you couldn't compel form. May my form be like this. May it not be like that. And you could compel form. May my form be like this. May it not be like that. So don't get too verklempt over the word self. Self here isn't really a psychological quantity in ourselves. It's really a way of saying, let's take his definition here, right? If form were self, then you could compel self. You could cause it. May my form be like this. May my form not be like this. So let's start just there without getting too metaphysical. This thing that I might call myself, the definition the Buddha is giving it for it here is that it's a thing that you are in control of. So what if we just say, form is not my possession. It's not mine. If it were mine, and this is common in the early texts, the definition of ownership is control, right? You get to choose what happens to something. This is my book. If I want to burn it, I can. If I want to give it away, I can. If somebody takes it away from me, we call that stealing. I get to decide what happens to it. That's how we call it mine. If it's not mine, if it's like the library's, I'm not in perfect control of it, right? When it's time for it to go back to the library, I have to bring it back if I am, you know, respectful in that way. So the thing that we're going to call self is a thing that you can control. And in that sense, I think it's actually a pretty easy concept, right? We don't have to get into deep ideas about like, do I have a self or not? That's not what he says. The Buddha doesn't say, you have no self. What he says is, if this form were myself, I could make it be a certain way or make it not be a certain way. Can you do that? You can't do that, right? If I was in control of this thing, I would make it be any number of things, right? I would make it not be injured in this way that it's injured. I would make it not be grumpy, right? I would make it have more energy or less energy in a certain way. I would make it be stronger. I would make it be younger, right? I would make it be, you know, sexier. I would make it be prettier. I would make it be smarter. I would make it be more creative. I would, well, you know, all the things, whatever you want. You don't get that, right? For all of those things that are, some of which are very healthy and desirable, you don't get to make them happen. All you can do is do things that might set up the conditions for them to happen, right? If you want to be stronger, you can exercise, and exercise might lead to that result, right? It might not, right? Something else might happen. You might get injured and not get stronger. Who knows, right? But all you can do is you can do actions that might give rise to a result, but that is not control. That doesn't mean may it be this way. We're just not in that kind of control. Likewise, right, may my form not be like this. You know, may I not get sick? May I not age? May I not get weak in this way? May I not injure myself? May I not, a number of things. And so then the Buddha goes through that formula for all five of the aggregates. If feeling were self, then I could compel it. May it be this way, may it be not be this way, right? May I have pleasant experiences, but not unpleasant ones. You know. I remember a really poignant moment. My kid was like three, and he was upset about something that wasn't going his way. You know, we weren't going to have ice cream or something at the right time, or the play wasn't going his way, and he was really asking like no, but why can't it go? Essentially, like, why can't it go my way? And the, you know, the best answer I had at one point was like, because we had already talked through like the reasons, yes, because of this and this and this, therefore it's happening this way. But of course, it's not about that. It's just a feeling. The feeling is like, why can't it go my way? And I remember it saying like, yeah, sometimes we get what we want and sometimes we just don't. And you know, like, ouch, right? And just how direct we got to be, you know, like we got to kind of just cry together about like, yeah, sometimes it's not going the way you want, you know? And so, you know, as always, interventions that are good for toddlers are often good for us adults as well. So, you know, anytime you need to remind yourself like, oh, sometimes it just doesn't go the way you want, you know, and that's painful. Like, that's dukkha, right? That is unsatisfying. And so, so the first teaching, right, the setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, was really about suffering. It was like, yeah, sometimes things are unsatisfying, you know, and craving, really, really wishing in this kind of forceful way, holding on in the heart for them to be otherwise, that's what makes them really hurt the most. This second teaching says, well, you know, you can't call that kind of thing a self. So let's keep unpacking this self thing a tiny bit. Part of what I think that this bit about self is pointing to, you know, you can't control it, therefore. I think self, in a way here, is a stand-in for refuge, for like an island in the storm. What I hope for is that, you know, the world is chaotic and painful and all these things are happening, but you know, I just want to be able to rely on something. And, you know, the Buddha was really into independence. You know, he will come to say that the things you can rely on are the great refuges of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So there's the community of practitioners, there's the teachings, and there's the teacher. You know, your own body, your own feelings aren't a refuge because you can't rely on them. And I think in a certain way, this is one of those things that's cold comfort in the Buddha's teachings. You know, it doesn't actually rely on a story that we have to keep telling ourselves in order to feel it as a refuge. You know, there's not a God to rely on. There's not a story about, like, you know, the deep oneness of my body and the natural world. I can tell myself that story, but I think viscerally, you know, there's just these fundamental organic truths to not be in denial of. You know, I can't rely on the body to be strong, to be young, to be healthy. I can't rely on my feelings to be how I want them to be. And you know, stories. So I think so much spiritual, I want to say commodities. I want to say it in a way that's not too dismissive, but so much spiritual stuff in the modern world, memes, but teachings as well, you know, it really relies on stories and images and narratives. You know, remember that you're worthy. Like, that's a good teaching. But for it to be something that you can really rely on, you have to remind yourself of it, or you have to learn it deeply enough, that it's known, you know, that it's actually able to interrupt the force of delusion or the force of doubt. And stories that are narrative, you know, sankhara, they can't be a refuge, right? You can't actually control them. You can't make yourself believe something, you know. There's things in the Dharma itself that I tried for years to just believe, and I'm like, you know, the Buddha would say, don't believe it just because I said it, or because wise teachers said it, but you have to find out for yourself. And so there are still some things that I only provisionally believe, like they make sense to me, but, you know, until I can completely see them for myself, you know, I'm going on faith. And ultimately, that can't be a refuge, right? And I think part of what that means is that when in our lives, you know, when the shit really hits the fan, when things are just rough, either externally or internally, where we don't really know how to be, the thing that's going to hold us is going to be some kind of refuge. What can we really drop down to that's a floor that gives us a base for knowing where we are, for being oriented at all in a confusing world. And I mean, part of what this teaching is of not self is to protect us in a way from thinking that one of these things, one of these aggregates, you know, something about the body or the earth, something about feelings, perceptions, something that's in the realm of belief or worldview or narrative, is going to be enough when things get really hard. And the Buddha is saying, it's not going to be. That's not how it works. The only thing that can be truly relied on, you know, is awakening. But the path to that awakening in the form of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, that's where you can turn for real refuge. And so the not self teaching says, if you can't control it, you can't rely on it. Yeah. And again, I want to be careful here to not forget the refuges, particularly the refuge of Sangha, the refuge of the Dhamma. You know, to say like, I can't control it, therefore I can't rely on it. One of the things, for instance, I'm thinking about the refuge of Sangha, you know, the spiritual community. There's certainly a way that like specific individual people, as much as we want to, right, are unreliable. Not because they're untrustworthy at all, but because they're subject to the same forces we are. So, you know, I can take refuge in the Sangha broadly, the Sangha of practitioners. But if I took refuge in any particular expression of the Sangha, you know, like these exact dozen people, you know, this exact cohort, you know, you people, you are my, you know, my core refuge. That would be dangerous, right? Because everyone is subject to the same conditions of impermanence and change and loss. And, you know, we grow up, perhaps, you know, if we're lucky to have some, to know our parents and to have some stability in the family circle and some positivity in the family circle, all of which are privileges, we may grow up with the sense that the family is a deep refuge. And, you know, my sense of the family as refuge was not entirely solid. It was a little bit fractured for various reasons, but there was some of that. And, you know, as many of you know, my father just passed away a couple weeks ago, and one of the things that I can feel is that any sense that I may have still had that there was a kind of a human family refuge, right? In the very specific, like, I can go back to that house and that person if things go poorly, right? That has changed. And that's true all that's true with everyone. That's true with our, you know, all the aspects of our human communities. And so the refuge in Sangha can't be to specific aggregates, you know, this form, this feeling. But there must be something that is bigger than that, more reliable than that, you know. And there can be, you know. I remember the first time I felt that I was at my first Zen monastery. I was quite young, maybe 23. I was living at this monastery in New Mexico, and it was just an ordinary day there. I was doing practice, working in the kitchen. But I realized that I had landed there, and they had asked very little money of me, and that I could just move in, and I didn't have to keep paying to be there. Like, I had paid a little bit when I first arrived, and then they just put you on staff, and then you're just a resident there. They know you're not making any money. And I knew that if I wanted to, I could become ordained and just stay. And then I realized that there were places like this all over the world that would just take me, you know, that I could join. And when I realized that, I realized also that without even knowing it, kind of unconsciously, I'd always been slightly afraid of not making it and becoming destitute. I'm like, what if I just can't, like, do it? What if I just can't make money or keep a job or have a house? Like, what if I'm just fail at those material things? Where will I go? And I realized that I had always been a little bit afraid of just being homeless, essentially, you know, unable to make it in the world. And realizing that there was this place that I could go. And this was, you know, this was an immature realization of that. This was like a young kid in his early 20s, realization of that. But it was very powerful to realize that there was, this might also be a very American experience, right? To realize that there was actually a safety net, right? Because there's not really a social safety net here in the way that many of us would like. And, you know, but the Sangha in part can be that. And, you know, that there's any number of monasteries or Buddhist centers. Certainly places in every religion are like this, but I'll speak to the Buddhists because I trust them the most. That you could go, and you could take refuge in Sangha, and they would take you, and you could stay forever and be fed and clothed and cared for. And so I can't separate the Buddha's giving this teaching on the not self characteristic from the founding of the monastic order. These are the first five monks, and he has taken this group of this kind of anarchic group of friends who were just kind of practicing together in the woods, starving themselves. And he's turned them into a functional small community where they're going for alms together, feeding each other. And then he's given them exactly the right teachings over the course of this first week to bring all of them to liberation. And they become the Sangha. They are the Sangha at that point. And it grows from there. And so in this teaching of the not self characteristic, where these aggregates, all these aggregates have this characteristic of not self. And the text goes on to weave in the third of the characteristics, you know, the form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness, they are the aggregates affected by clinging, therefore they give rise to suffering. They can't be called a self, and they can't be called permanent, right? They don't last. And so then you get there, it completes the set of the first three characteristics, the lakana, the tilakana, the three marks or characteristics, impermanence, dissatisfactoriness, and selflessness. And so I can just feel together this presentation of, you know, this is not a refuge. This is going to be a refuge, with the beginning of the creation of what's going to be the refuge for all of them for the rest of their lives and for thousands of the people that will join them, that now there is the Buddha present in the world. There is a new Buddha in the world after a long period of not having a teacher like this in the world. And then the Dhamma has been brought into the world. The wheel of the Dhamma has been turned, right? That was the first teaching, setting in motion the wheel. And now the Sangha has been formed. And the beginning of the monastic Sangha has come together and has begun to function as a community. And so the Buddha says, these things are a true refuge. And the Sangha itself is a true refuge. And these aggregates of form and feeling and all the rest, these are not a true refuge. And so we can't call them a self. All right, I'll pause there.